Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, and we have a big milestone today. I want to thank all of you so much for listening for so long, and this is our 100th episode. Yes, episode number 100. It's a big milestone where we continue to talk about protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. And as such, every 10th episode, we go off topic and we discuss something that's just of general life enrichment. And the 100th episode is also a 10th episode at the same time. So we will do that again today as we have a great guest for you. Also, I just want to encourage you to check out my other shows as well, like the Creating Wealth Show. Remember, the three pillars of holistic survival are people, places, and profits. Profits are obviously a very important part of this, the financial side of life, the economic side of life, and how it integrates with holistic survival as one of those three pillars. So you can find the Creating Wealth Show at jasonhartman.com, or if you're an iTunes user, you can find all of my shows in the iTunes store. We have 15 different shows that we produce through the Hartman Media Company, and you just go to the iTunes store and type in Jason Hartman in the search, and you'll find all the shows, and of course, everything is free. I do another show a lot of people that listen to Holistic Survival like quite a bit that's also about the profit side of things, and that is the Speaking of Wealth Show. Strategies for podcasters, small business people, infopreneurs, authors, publishers, coaches, etc. So a lot of good stuff there for you, and I interview all of the leaders in each of their respective fields on the Creating Wealth Show, the Speaking of Wealth Show, and all of the shows that I produce. So without further ado, let's jump into a 10th episode and also the 100th episode today. And thank you so much for making the show such a big success, telling all of your friends, family, and associates about the show and helping people prepare, because there will be much less of a need to prepare for things in these uncertain times if more people are prepared, because there won't be a crisis if people prepare in advance. So let's talk about protecting the people, places, and profits as we go into the 100s on the future episodes. And again, thank you so much for listening. We'll be right back with today's guest.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn how to finance your next big real estate deal, there's a show for that. If you want to learn more about food storage and the best way to keep those onions from smelling up everything else, there's a show for that. If you honestly want to know more about business ethics, there's a show for that. And if you just want to get away from it all and need to know something about world travel, there's even a show for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. Only from jasonhartman.com, or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
My pleasure to welcome Clay Jenkinson to the show. He is one of the most sought-after humanities scholars in the United States. He's a cultural commentator, and he studies extensively Jefferson and our original intent. And so I'm looking forward to hearing more about the founding of our nation and learning a lot about it today and getting a lot of history. Clay, welcome. How are you?
Jason, it's great to be on your program. Thanks to you and to your listeners.
My pleasure. So tell us a little bit about your background, if you would.
Well, I'm a North Dakotan. And I came from the agricultural background that is really the heritage of North Dakota. I studied at the University of Minnesota and then at Oxford University. And my degrees are all in literature, but I'm basically now a historian and with a deep interest in the Lewis and Clark expedition and in the life and achievement of Thomas Jefferson.
Fantastic. And when we talk about Jefferson and the other founders, what is it that we are maybe so misguided about today? Maybe that's a good place to start is talk about some of the misconceptions that people have about Jefferson and, you know, some of the other more prominent founders.
Well, I think the main misconception is that the founding fathers had a single vision which they offered to the future of the United States. That's completely wrong. The founding fathers were men like other men, and they disagreed about a great number of issues. And the Constitution that was drafted in 1787 was a compromise document, compromise between large states and small, compromise between people who wanted a centralized national government and those who preferred states' rights. A compromise between the North, which wanted to outlaw slavery, and the South, which wanted to keep it. The North, which wanted to be a more industrial capitalist region, and the South, which wanted to remain an agrarian one. And so you have these extraordinary men from all over the original 13 colonies coming together in Philadelphia in 1787 to try to hammer out a constitution, and they produced one, and a great one. But it wasn't a unanimously accepted vision of this country, and the Constitution contains all of these fault lines which continue to be a source of political and constitutional tension in the United States. So I think that's the main myth. The second myth that I'll say more quickly is that many people believe that the Founding Fathers intended the United States to be a Christian nation. Many of the Founding Fathers were Christians, of course, some of them very pious Christians, but the Constitution itself never mentions God or religion except that it outlaws testos. You can't say to a political candidate, you must swear to be an Anglican or you must swear not to be a Catholic in order to run for office. But beyond that, the Constitution is absolutely silent on questions of religion. And so we can attempt to infer what the Founding Fathers had in mind with respect to religion, but we can't find any doctrine within the Constitution itself.
Well, you know, some argue that the reason that God is so conspicuously, maybe some would think that, left out is because of the Church of England and their experience with that. And they never, some would argue that they certainly didn't intend to have such a large, for example, Muslim community over in the U.S. It was obviously a very different world then. Some say that maybe they would have said something about the national language. It's impossible to see 230 some odd years into the future, of course. But, you know, what are your thoughts when you hear things like that out there? I'm sure you didn't hear them from me the first time just now. What are your thoughts about those?
Well, let's start with original intent. You know, if the subject is original intent, then we have to go to the Constitution and the notes we have of the deliberations and debates and the notes we have from the ratification events, symposiums and conferences and conventions that occurred around the country, and try to figure out both what the Constitution actually says and what the Founding Fathers said about it when they were debating it. So that's where you start. And since the Constitution doesn't say anything about English being the national language of the United States, and nor did anyone in the debates, then if we like original intent, we can't go back and say, well, I assume that if they knew then what we know now, they would have wanted English to be the official language of the country. That's a violation of the very concept of original intent. Original intent means you go to the document and the debates that surround it, and you say, what's there and what's not there? And if you believe that we should operate according to original intent, then we have to adhere to what's in the Constitution and its immediate surroundings, but not impose anything on it that we think the Founding Fathers might have wanted had they known who we would be.
Fair enough. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. However, people want to interpret things by saying, well, the context in which the document was drafted and the context of their thinking at the time was, of course, a much different world without travel and so forth at the time. And, you know, everything was massively different. Populations were much lower, et cetera. And they want to sort of interpret, well, what would they have done today? I guess that's maybe the more proper way to couch the or frame the question.
Right, of course, and the minute you do that, and let's take something like cloning or DNA research that enables you to determine whether O.J. Simpson murdered his wife or not, or cyber pornography. These were things that not only didn't exist in the age of the Founding Fathers, but they could not even have imagined them. I mean, none of the Founding Fathers could have imagined the genetic code and that somehow DNA would enable us to decide questions of paternity or determine whether somebody had committed a crime. They couldn't anticipate these things, and so they didn't write about them. And now we're stuck with this Constitution. It's a great one, but we're stuck with it more than 200 years after the fact. And when the courts, say the Fifth Circuit or the Ninth Circuit, takes up a case about DNA and its relationship to the Fourth Amendment or the Fifth, then the courts have to step back and say, well, how would you, what would you do, or what would you take from the Constitution that could be somehow seen to fit this set of circumstances that none of them could even have imagined in their wildest dreams? You can see the problem there, that it forces jurists in our time to stretch an 18th century document from a 3-mile-per-hour world and to try to fit it to a 21st century culture that travels at 186 miles per second. And so how do you do that? It requires what conservatives like to call judicial activism. But you either have to do that, you either have to let jurists stretch the 18th century text to fit 21st century conditions, or you need to tear up the Constitution and write a new one or amend it to face questions of cloning and DNA and biogenetics and pornography and so on. So it's a paradox, isn't it? There isn't an easy way to do this.
No, there's no easy way to do it, of course.
And every time the Supreme Court says, well, we guess that the Ninth Amendment gives you privacy rights to contraception, or we think that the implication of the Fourth Amendment is that you must have the Miranda rights read to an accused person, then people squawk and say, that's not what the Founding Fathers intended. How dare you tell us that the Founding Fathers meant that when they never said anything about it? And so both sides, the conservatives principally, but the liberals from time to time too, say, hey, these jurists have absolutely no right to take an 18th century phrase and pretend that they know what it might mean in a 21st century context. And so everyone complains about every judicial decision which is against their own set of principles and applauds every judicial decision which seems to resonate with their principles. And it creates an enormous amount of national frustration and confusion. And I hasten to add again, it's from both sides. The conservatives do it more often than the liberals, but the liberals do it every time they're annoyed with a Supreme Court decision.
Yeah. Maybe, you know, just in fairness, in defense of conservatives for a moment here, maybe the reason conservatives do it more is because their philosophy, it certainly could be argued, is more based on constitutional thinking, you know, limited government, states' rights, etc., than the left side of the aisle. I mean, is that a fair way to view that?
Well, you're right, of course, up to a point. But just take the rise of the Tea Party, and I have a lot of respect for the Tea Party, by the way, but you hear them talking about taxes and regulation and big government and government intrusion and states' rights and the Tenth Amendment, and these are all sort of rallying cries of the movement, and they're good ones, and yet you don't hear them saying that wars that we're fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq, which have never been declared by the House of Representatives, or extraordinary renditions, where we send prisoners to foreign countries for torture, or Guantanamo, or any of these things, or the CIA, or the National Security Agencies, or any of the surveillance regimens that we develop. You never hear the Tea Party people saying, and those things, by the way, are also fundamental violations of the original texts of the Constitution of the United States. So there's this one-sidedness. I agree with you that conservatives are more likely to want to adhere to the Jeffersonian limited government, light regulation, low taxation model that Jefferson so beautifully espoused, but they're inconsistent in not condemning the CIA and not condemning Guantanamo and so on. So that bothers me, because you need to be consistent, and so do the liberals. But everyone invokes the original intent so far as it suits their purposes and no farther, in my view.
Fair enough. Of course they do. That's human nature, right? And I guess the only few people out there that do condemn those things are, of course, Ron Paul and Lyndon LaRouche, frankly.
and Buchanan.
Well, and Buchanan, certainly, yes.
But you know, I gave a Jefferson performance. I sometimes perform as Thomas Jefferson and try to portray him as accurately as I can. I gave a performance before a retreat in Pennsylvania, and a prominent United States senator came up afterwards and said, "Hey, Mr. Jefferson, you're Pat Buchanan. You're an isolationist. You want limited government. You believe in states' rights. You believe in individual responsibility. You're against the centralized state. You're anti-tax." He said, "You're not Thomas Jefferson. You're Patrick Buchanan." I think Ron Paul is the most prominent and I think the most consistent living Jeffersonian. And he rubs a lot of Republicans the wrong way, and virtually all Democrats, by the way, but he rubs a lot of Republicans the wrong way because he says, well, why are we giving help to the people of Afghanistan, and why do we invade Iraq, and why do we have 750 military bases scattered around the world, and what sense is that the intent of the libertarian founding fathers? And so I like his consistency, but you see, however much we all kind of smile and admire him, we're not about to let that be the governing doctrine of the United States in the 21st century. So it's a sort of, we have this nostalgia that Ron Paul beautifully articulates, but we're not actually going to return to that model, are we?
Well, no. Arguably, in today's highly interconnected world, you can't be so isolationist like that. I think that argument has some validity, but at the same time, my personal opinion is that we're massively overreaching. So I fall somewhere in between. But I believe it was Washington who was quoted as saying, you know, avoid foreign entanglements, right?
Well, actually, it was Jefferson, but both of them were relative isolationists. And Jefferson really believed, and he's where I have my greatest historical expertise, but he believed that the 3,000-mile ocean between us and Europe was a moat that protected North America and the Western Hemisphere from the madness and the havoc and the class struggles and the chaos of the old world. And he once said that he wished the Atlantic Ocean were an ocean of fire. You know, he wanted us to be a separate national experiment in human happiness and believe that the less we had to do with Europe and the rest of the world, the better. Well, that makes sense when a large boat is essentially a yacht, and if Napoleon had wanted to invade the United States, he would have had to send the troops on these tiny boats. They would have taken 6 or 7 weeks to get here. By then, they would have scurvy, and they would be malnourished, and we could just pick them apart at the shore. But today, a cruise missile can leave, let's say, Tehran, or for that matter, Norfolk, and 30 minutes later have brought havoc to a people across the planet. So we have to realize that the technologies and the speed and the pace and the electronic communications and satellite technology and so on and so forth of our time have sort of fundamentally altered this set of things. Or to go to one other area, I mean, take Ron Paul's laissez-faire idea, let the buyer beware, let there be a free economy. I'm not sure that I want there to be no air traffic control. And yet in a strict libertarian world, there wouldn't be. And I'm not too sure I want, when my daughter has a throat infection, to go into a pharmacy and see 700 different cures and not knowing whether some of them are carrot juice or arsenic or actual antibiotics. But in a strictly libertarian world, there'd be no Food and Drug Administration. There would be no meat inspection. There would be no air traffic control. We'd have, the buyer would have to beware in all circumstances. I don't think you want to live in that world, do you?
You know, I don't. And a lot of libertarians say, you know, everybody's sort of got their three things. I don't want to live in a world where I walk into a building and you know, I'm not sure whether the structure will fall on my head and kill me or not.
So we need building inspection and code.
Fair enough. So, hey, you brought this up, Clay. So may I run an idea by you that I've had for
sure.
A long time? And I talk about it with some people from time to time. And you're a historian, so this is maybe not exactly your thing. But, you know, with what you just said, you seem like the kind of person to run it by. And I can't seem to poke too many holes on this idea. So just so you know where I'm coming from, I'm pretty libertarian. I believe in very small government. I think the government, at least at the federal level, could be about 70% smaller, and I think we'd be a more prosperous, better society. But everything you say, you know, I almost never in my whole life, in all these years, get sick of eating at a restaurant. because we have health inspectors and laws and so forth. But here's a thought about that. For everybody who wants to produce something in society, whether it be a drug or a building or to serve food to people, instead of having government be the one that regulates and controls and so forth, government would simply make a law that would say, if you want to do this, you have to have insurance. And then the insurance policy would, the insurance company would then be the inspector. They would be the health inspector. They would be the building inspector. And you would basically privatize inspection. Now, just so you know, many years ago when they talked about privatizing prisons, I was in favor of the idea, but I have read and heard a lot of things about that going badly already. And we have this hugely incarcerated population, especially in California. And, you know, I think prison's becoming a business. But then again, government becomes a business too. I mean, giving out parking tickets and fines to businesses becomes a business of government where they can produce revenue. So government kind of goes into business against its own citizens too sometimes.
Well, let me respond to that. I mean, first of all, I like your idea. I heard a speech by Newt Gingrich once on television, that is, on C-SPAN, and he was saying, why is it that FedEx and UPS work so brilliantly and efficiently?
And they can't do postage.
And the post office system can't. And he said, why, when you go to the DMV to get your driver's license or to renew your tags, is it like being in Dante's Inferno? And you're sent back after 3 hours because you don't have a recently canceled stamp on a letter to your home or whatever. So, and yet, if this were done by FedEx, we know it would be extraordinarily efficient and customer friendly. He said, you have to understand that the private sector is just much better at this than the public sector. And I was really taken with that. And I do think you're right, but there are some issues, of course. And one of them is equality of access. The post office has to deliver to every domicile in North America. I know places where FedEx won't go. So you'd have to work in some distributive justice, saying, well, you have to serve everybody. Maybe it costs a little more if you're living in Ritchie, Montana, but you still have to serve them. So there's one issue is distributive justice. With prisons, I share your new view. I think prisons should never be done for profit. There's just something philosophically repugnant about a corporation profiting from the incarceration of men and women. That, I think, is something that government should reluctantly do by itself. But I'll take your bait. I think we should privatize absolutely everything that can be privatized, with a certain number of exceptions where severe health and safety issues are at stake, as in air traffic control and so on.
Air traffic control is probably too big for any one private entity to take on. Gosh, talk about a problem with too big to fail. You know,
FedEx would do it better, though. I mean, I don't doubt that they do it better,
right.
but questions of these deep security questions,
right,
I think, have to remain in government, just as we don't have mercenary armies, although, in fact, we do.
Well,
but, I mean,
we do.
Our main defense program is non-mercenary, and I think that's essential too.
Sure. But you know, just in the example of, say, food or building inspection, can you address your thoughts on that? I mean, you know, have an insurance company, and the insurance company would have to inspect and continue to inspect, and the law would be that you have to have a policy or you can't be in business.
I can see it. I mean, I think there are many paths to good ends, and, you know, the FedEx analogy works for me in many different zones. But I don't see anything particularly appalling about a county in California, let's say San Bernardino County, having its own building codes and building inspectors. I mean, you could privatize it if you wish, and you might gain a more streamlined system that would be more customer-friendly in certain ways. But I don't think that when we're talking about examples of tyranny or wild misuse of government, that building inspection is one of them. And there are public safety questions involved here that I think go beyond. If you take your model, you could say that a company would say, well, we'll build 17 high-rises in San Francisco, and we won't make them earthquake-proof because the statistics show that the earthquakes only come once every X number of decades, and they never take out seven different neighborhoods at the same time. So probably five of our high-rises will survive, and if we work out
they start
the math,
doing actuarial tables,
we can pay for the damages for the people who die in high-rises 1, 2, and 7. A purely capitalist model can't be counted on to do that extraordinary thing, which is to say our duty, our mission is to protect everybody irrespective of the cost. And I think that's important.
Yeah, yeah. You know what? That's a good example you just gave, because it's really, it's the Ford Mustang exploding gas tank. That,
right.
that business decision was made at the peril of people, unfortunately, and it was just an actuarial decision. You know, it was a cost-benefit analysis, unfortunately.
I like regulation. I just think we need to do what Al Gore tried to do in the Clinton administration and what it comes up from time to time. We need to go through and say, all right, which of these regulations is actually costing us enterprise? Which of them is impeding the economy? Which one is needless? How can we streamline this? What groups can we bring together to tell us which ones work and which ones don't? Are there ways to combine these and to limit the amount of bureaucracy? I mean, I think in a complex industrial urban society like ours, you need a regulatory environment. The question is, at what point does it stifle free enterprise? But you have to ask on the other end of that, Jason, how many redwood trees would be left if Theodore Roosevelt hadn't created timber protection in the United States? I mean, the corporations do not have, from the 19th and 20th century historical perspective, a very good record of self-regulatory activity.
I agreed, especially now, because it seems that in the not too olden days, and I'm really talking 15, 20 years ago before globalization took hold, corporations were like the home team. They were much better citizens in the past, I believe. Now they just go from border to border. They just hop, skip, jump wherever the tax code is better and the labor is cheaper. And there's something to be said for that from a capitalist perspective, of course, but it's like they have no corporate citizenship anymore. And you know, the same things happen in sports, and I'm no big sports fan by any means, but the concept of free agency, I mean, in the old days, you had sort of a home team, and it seemed like there was just a lot more loyalty and care, and like, we're going to set an example. You know, there was like, people took ownership.
Well, absolutely. You know, Jefferson here, again, has something to say. He loved agriculture and he loved farmers, and he famously said, "Those who labor in the earth are the chosen people of God." And when he envisioned an American republic that was happy and free, he always thought that the great majority of the people would have to be family farmers. Well, that's no longer true. You know, fewer than 2% of the American people are now farmers, and most of them are agri-producers rather than family farmers in any meaningful sense. So that's gone. And Jefferson, in the same essay in Notes on Virginia, said, "Merchants have no country." And that's what you're saying, that, you know, if I'm Monsanto and I have a plant in Pierce, South Dakota, and I'm producing something that's quite valuable, but then I realize that I can cut my labor costs in half or maybe by 90% by going to Taiwan, then I'm going to do that. And when we allow corporations to do that, which they have every right to do, we must at least realize that we don't need to give them economic incentives to do that. And so we have, as I think you will agree, we have such a deep corporate welfare problem in this country. It's as large as the private welfare problem that we have. Everyone's at the trough, corporations and individuals, and we've got to correct that. We have to say, hey, you want to take your factory offshore? You go ahead, but we're not going to give you incentives and tax rebates and other forms of remuneration for doing something that actually erodes the Commonwealth of the United States.
Let me take a brief pause. We'll be back in just a minute.
I've never really thought of Jason as subversive, but I just found out that's what Wall Street considers him to be.
Really? Now, how is that possible at all?
Simple. Wall Street believes that real estate investors are dangerous to their schemes because the dirty truth about income property is that it actually works in real life.
I know. I mean, how many people do you know, not including insiders, who created wealth with stocks, bonds, and mutual funds? Those options are for people who only want to pretend they're getting ahead.
Stocks and other non-direct traded assets are a losing game for most people. The typical scenario is you make a little, you lose a little, and spin your wheels for decades.
That's because the corporate crooks running the stock and bond investing game will always see to it that they win. This means, unless you're one of them, you will not win.
And unluckily for Wall Street, Jason has a unique ability to make the everyday person understand investing the way it should be. He shows them a world where anything less than a 26% annual return is disappointing.
Yep, and that's why Jason offers a one-book set on creating wealth that comes with 20 digital download audios. He shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I like how he teaches you how to protect the equity in your home before it disappears and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
And this set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered for only $197.
To get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia Book 1, complete with over 20 hours of audio, go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you.
What would the founding fathers have thought about lobbyists? Because what you just said, it's all about the lobbyists, and that is just the scourge of our society, I think. That's what brings about corporate welfare, all these special interests. It seems like they're just destroying the system. The lobbying has just got to.
Well, it's lobbying, of course, but there's always been lobbying since the beginning of the Republic. There's been somebody out in the lobby who says, I think that the New England mills need a better tariff situation, otherwise the British mills will defeat us. I mean, that's always been the case, and it's not inevitably bad. I mean, I think we demonize lobbyists a little more than maybe we necessarily ought to. They often provide a good information basis for legislators. But the problem of money in our politics, especially since that ridiculous Supreme Court decision, I think is going to ruin us. I have a plan for this. We'll see if you like it. No one likes it, but it actually is very Jeffersonian.
And you're talking about the Supreme Court decision from, I believe it was last year, right?
Right.
Just remind us of that decision. It was so big corporations can donate unlimited amounts of money, or they raise the contribution?
The large corporations can give infinite amounts of money. There is no limit.
Oh, scary.
Not to a candidate. They can't give it to Mitt Romney, but they can give it to a super PAC that you and I create some afternoon, as Colbert has on the Colbert Report. And then we can have $1 billion in that super PAC, and we can give that to campaign flights, to rallies, to advertising, to television. So you can't give it to Romney or Barack Obama, but you can give it to you and to me, and then we can spend it on those very candidates in any way we please. The court found this decision based upon the notion that free speech is free speech, and if I have $1 to spend, why is that different from having $1 billion to spend, and that speech is money in a media society and money is speech. I get their decision, but it's a ruinous one. So here's my solution. You're from California.
Originally,
you have two senators in California. Instead of running for the Senate, a group of 20 people or 10 people would run for the Senate pool. So you'd have all these people. You and I would run, and Barbara Boxer and so on and so forth. We'd all run, and if we won, we'd get into the pool, and the pool would consist of 10 or 20. But at that point, dice would be thrown, and one of us would be named senator. This way, there's a disincentive for any individual or corporation to give very much money to anybody because there's a random element in it, but the people create a kind of a, almost like the Electoral College, they create a college of prospective senators, and then from that, a couple of them are chosen more or less by a random generation machine to actually serve. If you did this, why would Monsanto Corporation or Chevrolet, General Motors, give $1 billion to any of them? They wouldn't dare. They'd have to spread that money so thin. Or you could do what European countries do and simply say there will be no private campaign donations, that the media, because it's partly state-owned or state-governed at least, will supply X number of minutes to each candidate between September 1st and November. But that would shatter the capitalist system. There's more money being spent on the campaign of 2012 than is spent in the budget of Montana, North Dakota, Wyoming, Arizona combined.
Yeah, that's a very interesting idea, and as long as that's layered in with term limits, but I guess those are automatic term limits. Did you say, and pardon me if I missed it, the amount of time after they are randomly selected?
I would, what I would do is, you could, I mean, because it's random, so you have to stand for re-election, so you still have to go back into the same dice throw, and, you know, if you do any statistical theory, you're
but
not
But is it on
win.
The same terms with 2 and 4
yeah,
years?
Yeah, but I would add some weight. It'd be, let's just say it's 6 years, so that the first time you're on a random generation, maybe to honor incumbency, the second time we give you 2 throws of the dice, but the third time back to 1, and the fourth time a half a throw. I mean, you
But why should we honor incumbency? That's an interesting point right there. Why? Why? What? Why should?
Well,
the
you, I mean,
it?
If you want to live in Jefferson's or in a sort of an Athenian world where every year we gather 535 people from around the country and put them into Congress, there would be some wonderful virtues to that. I mean, I can imagine how almost extraordinarily welcoming that response would be when they looked at things that now are so hidebound and rootbound that they're never touched. I would love to see the fresh air of all of that. But the fact is that you and I, or I'll speak for myself, if I had to describe exactly how a cell phone works or exactly how a heart pacemaker works, I couldn't if my life depended upon it. We are now in such a complex society that one senator, like Ted Kennedy, will become an expert on health care, welfare rebates, and another senator will become an expert on air traffic control, and a third senator will be an expert on foreign military bases or the cruise missile. And you almost need, in the complexity of our culture, to have one of two things, either some senior statesmen who have given their lives to one or two great issues with all of their complexities, or you need a British-style bureaucracy filled with life-tenured bureaucrats who become experts on all of these subjects. But I don't think that a pure citizen legislature would be able to swim its way through DNA testing, for example. They would have to, they'd have to call on outside experts.
Well, you know who those outside experts are? They're called
FedEx.
Lobbyists. No, they're lobbyists. And
you could
really
do it.
If you think about it, lobbyists know more about their way around Washington than the actual people in government do, because they're there for life usually. I mean,
yeah,
you
but
know,
the problem with that,
unfortunately,
is
a lot of the politicians
saying,
are too. But
the lobbyist is saying, "Oh, we don't want any more clean air standards. That would destroy the coal industry, and we don't want any crop rotation systems put in our national forests because that would make it impossible for us to cut timber and make a profit." You can't let them run the world. You have to have the check of somebody who's not in the profit mode.
Yeah, and remember, I was the one who said I didn't like lobbyists at all.
I take your point. Jefferson would say, let's just stay with Jefferson. Jefferson would say, take 535 people randomly generated from the 330 million Americans and put them in Congress, and you will get better government, which is more respectful of your sovereignty, your private rights, and your hard-earned tax dollars than any system that we now have. And Jefferson would absolutely believe that, A, the people are up to it, and B, people that are not tied to big money are much more likely to actually legislate on behalf of their fellow citizens in a rational and virtuous way. So if you want to be a true Jeffersonian, I mean, he tends almost towards Athenian-style democracy. Jefferson believed, this is a paradox, but Jefferson believed that the people are always right, even when they're wrong. And so, in other words, if you and I had a Jeffersonian legislature, we might write a bill which erodes freedom of speech. Jefferson's view would be, that's not good, because that violates the First Amendment. But better that the people wrestle with this and come back next year and reform and clarify it, better that than that 9 unelected and unaccountable members of the Supreme Court sit outside the process and decide what's law and what isn't.
I agree with, wasn't it the case in the early years that our government, all of our government representatives, senators, Congress, weren't they like all part-timers that just, they ran businesses and did jobs and had careers and just did the government thing part-time? It was never really a full-time thing before in the old days.
No, it wasn't. Jefferson himself, as president, said he would refuse under any circumstances to stay in Washington, D.C., the new capital, in August and September, because it was a malarial climate in an age before antibiotics, and certainly it was an age before air conditioning and dehumidifiers. So Jefferson just said flat out, I won't stay. And Congress only was in session for a handful of weeks per year back in that era. In fact, later, when Theodore Roosevelt became the vice president to the United States. He presided over the Senate. He presided over it for 5 days in the spring of 1901, and then they adjourned until December. And Roosevelt went off and wrote books and climbed mountains and shot things. Well, it was during that period that McKinley was assassinated, and Roosevelt, during this almost endless congressional recess, became the 26th president of the United States. So we were a part-time legislature until very recently, and you know what, Jason, we still are. Here's the horrible truth about things today. Senators are in session, or representatives, between Tuesday and Thursday afternoon. Friday they fly home to California or Oregon or Mississippi, spend the weekend raising the $2 million they need to stay in office that month, and then they go back on Monday, and on Tuesday they turn up. The reason we have no collegiality and no friendships and no sense of community in Washington is that we have too much mobility. What we should do is say, once we elect you, stay there. You know, come back once every 6 months, but stay in Washington and have friends and have dinner parties and cross the aisle and say hello to the senator from the other side and go out for a drink and take a walk and ride a horse. But don't be coming home every weekend, because when you do, then you just become an isolated atom in Congress, and you don't create the trust levels and the community that would lead to conciliation.
Yeah, fair enough. Good point. And they'd also make their carbon footprint a lot smaller too.
Well, they come home. I have friends who are North Dakota U.S. senators and representatives. We have one representative, but they come back on Friday or Thursday. I see them at the airport. They get off the plane, and there's a group from the coal industry or the oil industry or agribusiness or something waiting for them. They go out for dinner with these people who say that the republic will collapse absolutely if we charge one more dollar for water than we're currently charging. Then they go to a parade and a bunch of stuff on Saturday. They have dinner with another power group Saturday night. Sunday they spend a couple of hours with their family or do some media, and then they get on a plane and go back to Washington where they bicker with everybody else. I mean, this is no way to run a country.
And very interesting points. Well, hey, give out your website, if you would, and tell people where they can get your books and listen to your shows and so forth.
Oh, thanks for that offer, Jason. My Jefferson Hour, which is a weekly radio program, is available free on iTunes or at my website, which is jeffersonhour.org. One word, jeffersonhour.org. You have all the programs backlogged, and they're all podcastable and so on. I also perform as Jefferson and Meriwether Lewis and Theodore Roosevelt and J. Robert Oppenheimer and Steinbeck around the country, and I'm always glad to do that. You can go to my website, jeffersonhour.org. I'm also an author, and I have a new book, which I'm exceedingly proud of and would love to come back to talk about sometime. That's a book on Meriwether Lewis called The Character of Meriwether Lewis. You can find it on Amazon or in your local bookstore, but it's published by the Dakota Institute Press, distributed by the University of Oklahoma Press. I'm the author, Clay Jenkinson, and the title is The Character of Meriwether Lewis, Explorer in the Wilderness. So that's probably enough shameless Hamiltonian advertisement.
Hamiltonian, that's fantastic. Well, that's great. Just before you go, Clay, tell us one more bit of trivia or factoid about Jefferson that we may not know.
Well, here's one that's really lovely. Jefferson believed that in Newtonian balance, that country is best which has the smallest government, which does the least. Remember now, this is back in his 3-mile-per-hour world. So he suggested once that there be a mandatory waiting period of 1 year before the first reading and the second reading of any bill in Congress. So if you have a bill to, let's say, create a new canal in Mississippi, it can be read today, which is May of 2012, but it can't be brought up for its second reading and debate until May of 2013. Jefferson thought during that time, almost all knuckleheaded ideas will simply disappear and only good ones will still be talked about. And I think, you know, we couldn't do that, but that's a lovely response to the volatility and the faddishness of our Congress.
Yeah, maybe could we say that maybe it would be a month now or 2 months?
Well, how about a day? How about, you know, how about even an hour?
I
think we could adjust it, but you see the point. Jefferson's view was I'll close with this. He said that in the ancient world of Athens, when Solon was the great lawgiver, he reduced the number of legislative provisions in Athens until all of them could be written on a kind of a billboard, on one placard that was displayed in the public square in the Agora. And Jefferson said, that's the ideal. We should have so few laws and such wise ones that they would be within the comprehension of every citizen, and they could be written in plain English so they could be displayed in the public square and everyone would know the law code. Now just compare that for a second to, say, the U.S. tax code of thousands and thousands of intricate pages, giving freebies to people who don't deserve it.
Right. Great points. Clay, very, very interesting talk today, and we would love to have you back on the show. Maybe we'll talk about your other work at that time, but thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, Clay, if you get a good response, I'll come back and talk more Jefferson.
We'd love to hear it. Thanks so much, Clay.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you for joining us today for the Holistic Survival Show, protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Be sure to listen to our Creating Wealth Show, which focuses on exploiting the financial and wealth creation opportunities in today's economy. Learn more at www.jasonhartman.com or search Jason Hartman on iTunes. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, offering very general guidelines and information. Opinions of guests are their own, and none of the content should be considered individual advice. If you require personalized advice, please consult an appropriate professional. Information deemed reliable, but not guaranteed.